1, 2, 3, 4. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Andy That's in the Bonnevilles podcast. Episode number 17. This one's going to be a bit of a buckle up, motherfuckers. This one's going. I'm going long with this one. It's going to be wild. I want to talk to you about Michael Moore's new documentary, Planet of the Humans. Why it's all a crock of shit, and how we got here, in my opinion. So, buckle up. We're going to do this. Episode 17 incoming. Red alert, coming in hot. Okay, so first of all, I'm going to change the theme tune to my podcasts, because I've just realised I've been using music by one of my favourite bands, little known. They're not a huge band or anything, the Mortal Lee County Killers. But it means then that if I get a copyright strike on my YouTube videos, they could all be taken down. So I'm going to change the theme tune to some of my own music, and I'm going to change it to a song called We've Got Horns from my new album, my solo record as yet unreleased, which I've just finished this week. Happy about that. So that's that. That's why the theme has changed. And it's copy, so I can't be copyright struck against myself. So here we go. Michael Moore's new documentary, Planet of the Humans. The tobacco industry. The current COVID crisis. And the plethora of conspiracy theorists and theories that are doing the rounds. Why are they all linked? And are they linked? And I think they are. And this is why. I'm going to explain to you. So I'm going to do this podcast is going to be two episodes. I'm going to do part one and part two, simply because it's so expansive and I'm not going to get it all in half an hour, 30 minutes. But the first part, what I'm going to do is I'm going to explain why I think those four issues are all linked. And then the second part is going to be a thorough debunking of Michael Moore's documentary. Now, I have to thank certain people for providing me with a world of resources that I boned up on over the past few days. One guy in particular on Twitter from an organization called GetEnergySmartNow.com, and it goes under the title A Siegel. So it's at capital A underscore Siegel, S-A-E-G-E-L, who sent me a shit ton of stuff. Obviously knows his onions, this guy. And by the way, I will just say this before we start, I'm not an expert on fucking anything other than playing music, that's it. So anything that I get, but it's researched and by people that know much better and much more than me. So that's where I'm getting my information from, just to let you know. And I'm going to link everything that I speak about in the show notes. So on YouTube, there'll be a link to everything. On the podcasts, if you're hearing this podcast, I'll put a link to the YouTube, I guess, and you can check it from there, because the podcast show notes don't show up as links. It just shows up as a smattering of text that's going to be hard to decipher or hard to figure out what the fuck I'm talking about. So I'll just link to the YouTube video and all the show notes are going to be there. And again, if you're listening to this podcast, there's a video version of this on YouTube if you prefer to look at me instead of just hear me, because I'm fucking gorgeous, let's face it. So here we go. Buckle up. Michael Moore recently put out a documentary called Planet of the Humans. Now, it was released last year, and then he basically dumped it onto YouTube for free for all to watch on Earth Day, which was at the end of April there. And It immediately it went viral. It went huge, and initially, one might have thought, "Great, a documentary about our impending environmental catastrophe, that will maybe shake a few people into life, or certainly shine a light on the severity of the situation." That's no bad thing, in and of itself. But it became quite apparent very, very quickly that the documentary was basically horseshit. It was it's a terrible, terrible film. And Michael Moore, being a man of the left, immediately was immediately critiqued quite heavily by people generally considered of the left. And whenever you're reading the critiques of the film, a lot of them are quick to point that out, that they don't like criticizing Michael Moore. They feel very uncomfortable in this situation because they consider him a friend and an ally and a comrade. But he's got this one wrong. This is just wrong. And the plethora of debunking out there is just not hard to find. If you don't believe me or don't want to listen to it, Google it yourself. People that have been in the industry, that have been involved in the science, be it in a huge way or a small way, are all just poking holes in this thing wholesale. And it's not hard to see why, even by someone of my lack of understanding and certainly science-based understanding, most of my cares and concerns of the environment are all anecdotal and observed, and certainly not science-based. I mean, observed in my own the place that I live. So the documentary was released on Earth Day. A few people sent it to me, a few of my dear friends sent it to me, knowing that I would be interested in it, and they thought it was great. They didn't think it was great. They thought it was important. I'll be honest with you, the days of me watching environmental catastrophe documentaries, I think they're over, because I can't bear to watch another film of a fucking orangutan trying to fight off an earth mover or a digger while it's protecting its child. I can't do it. It just breaks my heart. And a bit of that was in the trailer, so it was obviously that was going to be it. So I kind of held off for a few days. They're very difficult to watch, these things, as you probably well know. So I held off. Then I started to get a few inklings of, picked up on a few on the grapevine. Few people breaking cover and dismissing this film. I hadn't gone into it at that point myself. So then I decided to watch it. And immediately, I'm not joking, and I didn't know what it was, but my antenna went up. My red alert system went up. I immediately sensed there was something wrong with this. And as a person that makes videos and is interested in making film and all the rest of it, again, not in any great way, very, very amateur, I was looking at the footage and I immediately went, when was this taken? Because the footage in the film, it's not that they use footage from then and then talking about stuff now, they're talking about stuff then, and it was obvious to me that this footage was taken quite a while ago. Then as the research started to come in, and some of the video and the points, major points in the film, is evidence based on scientific research or the technological capability of the day, and some of it is as far back as 2005, which in environmental technology terms is light years ago. So you're talking about solar panels from 2008 and which were in their infancy, and the green the green energy, let's call it industry, it got off to a few false starts. It didn't arrive fully formed. Nothing does, by the way. So don't be. That's not a critique. That's it. Its intentions are laid out, and they got off to a few false starts. Perfectly normal. And now we're up to speed, and this stuff works now. But it's presented in the film as not having worked. Now, part two of this podcast is going to be the next one, obviously, because this is the first one. I'm going to do the debunking of the film. But for part one, I want to make I'm going to make this critique. And it's this. A part of why we are here is because, and I'm talking about, when I say here, what I'm talking about is why the scientific evidence can be so freely and openly debased in our public realm. In our media circles, in our social media circles, which is a new phenomenon, and within our general landscape. So what happens when you go on, when you hear in the environmental issues being discussed on the news or discussed on current affairs programs or written about in articles or talked about in podcasts, what happens is you get this as a presentation of both sides of the argument. Right? So if you get an environmentalist on here in the UK, say Newsnight, then they will bring on someone to oppose the argument. In a 50-50, everyone's entitled to their opinion. As if that's fair, as if that's equal. And I'm here to tell you why it's not equal and why it's not fair. So without labouring, I'm going to get to my point. Back in the 50s, the tobacco industry. So the tobacco industry grew up in the 1800s. Basically, monopolies were formed. And they, through clever marketing, came to have complete ownership of an ubiquitous, unnecessary product, the cigarette. Think about it. The cigarette is completely pointless. It doesn't do anything. And it's environmentally harmful. It's physically harmful. And we don't need it. And the weird thing, it doesn't actually do anything. So if you think about, if you're going to smoke, like if you're going to smoke a joint, I understand that because it gets you high. What the fuck does a cigarette do? It doesn't do anything. But that's the weird thing. The thing that's banned is the thing that does stuff, that actually does, makes a change, does something to you. Whereas a cigarette, it doesn't do anything other than make you sick. And, you know, I'm assuming no one wants to pay for that. So by the time science could start to prove links between cigarette and lung cancer, we're talking the early 50s, the tobacco industry decided to do something about it because it became quite clear that the writing was on the wall, even as far back as then. So I'm going to read you some bits from this article. I'm going to link to this article, and I would urge you to read this. It's fucking fantastic. It's a wonderful, wonderful article. And you might be wondering, what's the link between tobacco industry and... It's all coming. Stay with me, right? So, inventing... The title of the article is called... It's not an article, it's a paper. Inventing Conflicts of Interest, A History of Tobacco Industry Tactics. Okay? So, and it's written by Alan M. Brandt. And it was in January the 1st, 2001. Now, all of the information in this by 2012, January 1st, 2012, it was when it was published. All of this has become sort of common knowledge about the tobacco industry's links with advertising and marketing. They basically, they didn't invent it, but the level of sophistication that they brought to marketing was, it just changed everything. Everything changed with tobacco when it comes to advertising, consumerism, capitalism, etc., etc. So I've a few tracks of text highlighted, and I'm going to read those out to you, but I would urge you to go and read the whole article, or the whole paper. It's not too bad. It's not very, it's lengthy, but it's not too lengthy. So, abstract. The first paragraph is titled abstract. So, confronted by compelling peer-reviewed scientific evidence of the harms of smoking, the tobacco industry beginning in the 1950s used sophisticated public relations approaches to undermine and distort the emerging science. Right? Goes on. A number of industries, and this is what we're talking about, a number of industries have subsequently followed this approach to disrupting normative science. Claims of scientific uncertainty and lacks of proof also led to the assertion of individual responsibility for industrially produced health risks. Now, that ties in two ways. A part of the Michael Moore documentary, the solution isn't green and sustainable energy or a change in from capitalism to a less destructive and invasive economic system. He promotes the idea at the end of the movie. That's not Michael. Well, Michael Moore's standing over it. It's the filmmaker himself. Michael Moore's a producer. He claims that global overpopulation is the problem and that all green energies, all renewable, they don't work, it's a waste of time, and they've all been co-opted by big industry anyway. Again, this is lengthy, I'm not going to read it all, I'll be here, this would be 2 hours long. So, the tobacco industry in crisis mode, early 50s, this is what's happening. You got to remember, the early 50s, you're living in the age of scientific discovery, scientific exploration. Albert Einstein is a modern pop culture hero. Nuclear age is happening. The space race has started. Come off the back of World War II, we're into the era of new technologies, new plastics, new fabrics, new products, all entering the marketplace. The modern world as we see it is starting to develop, right? So, within the industry, marketing experts had developed a powerful notion of social engineering. Tobacco industry and advertising marketing industry. What early public relations theorist Edward Bernays had called the engineering of consent. That is a fucking horrible phrase, isn't it? That sounds like it came out in 1984. The engineering of consent. According to the logic of this approach, society and culture could be manipulated through public relations to create a marketing environment that favoured a particular product. In this instance, the cigarette. Individuals' purchase of a particular product constituted their consent to the underlying meaning-centred campaigns. Now, we're all manipulated by marketing. I used to smoke as well. I preferred a particular brand over another. I used to smoke Marlboro because of the Marlboro Man at one point in my life. Seriously. So that's what that's. And you got to remember, this is at the birth. We now understand the psychology behind marketing and advertising, and industrial relations, and all these things are all connected. We understand the psychology behind it. But this is a science almost in its infancy. And when these ideas are presented, that there's a psychological aspect to your consumer choices, people don't understand it, they don't get it. But the cigarette industry got it. They got it early. And they got it very early, they got it way before anybody else. So engineering the science. If science had historically been dedicated to the making of new facts, the industry campaign now sought to develop specific strategies and unmake a scientific fact. This is by design. This is what I'm telling you. This is where we're going with this, right? The goal was to disrupt the normative processes of knowledge production in medicine, science, and public health. In the conduct of this public relations campaign, the tobacco industry would markedly alter the historical trajectory of industry-science relationships. Industry-stroke-science relationships. So the tobacco industry would markedly alter the historical trajectory of industry-science relationships. So it goes on, again, missing a little bit. For this reason, I met, and this is the author's own hypothesis. For this reason, I make a somewhat provocative claim that the industry invented the modern conflicts of interests that are now the subject of such intensive contention in the world of science and medicine, as well as media, politics, law, and policy. And that is my point, exactly my point. And that's why Michael Moore's documentary, the tobacco industry, Michael Moore's documentary, Our Current COVID Crisis, and the plethora of conspiracy theories that happened that are fucking everywhere are all connected. So, onward. Industry response to emerging tobacco science. With considerable anxiety. Now, you got to remember, the emerging tobacco science is the idea that smoking cigarettes is related to lung cancer specifically and other respiratory diseases. This is starting to, we're moving into a scientific age. People respect scientists, as I said, people like Albert Einstein and all these, you know, Niels Bohrs and all these are folk heroes by this point. So people respected scientists. Science is starting to say that the tobacco industry, smoking tobacco, causes lung cancer. Tobacco industry gathers itself up, starts to fight back. Tobacco industry is ahead of the curve when it comes to the marketing and advertising worlds. So they use that and they understand the power of that and the psychology involved in it. And they get that before anybody else. So, with considerable anxiety and rancor within the tobacco industry, and this is what we're talking about now, we're down to details here, names, dates, places and people. With considerable anxiety and rancor within the tobacco industry, the industry's highly competitive CEOs came together in December 1953 at the Plaza Hotel in New York City to map a strategy. They realized that the threat they now faced was unprecedented and would require new collaborative approaches and expertise. Not surprisingly, given their history, they turned again to the field of public relations that had served them so well in the past, and they called upon John W. Hill, the president of the nation's leading public relations firm, Hill & Knowlton. Machiavellian bastards. Skip forward a little bit. Hill offered the companies powerful advice and guidance as they faced their crises. Listen to this. Hill understood that simply denying emerging scientific facts would be a losing game. This would not only smack of self-interest, but also ally the companies with ignorance in an age of technological and scientific hegemony. So he proposed seizing and controlling science rather than avoiding it. Clever, clever man. If science proposed the principle, even terminal threat to the industry, Hill advised that the companies should now associate themselves as great supporters of science. The companies, in his view, should embrace a sophisticated scientific discourse. They should demand more science, not less. Does that sound familiar to you? Do you get that? Can you identify a point in your, and map your world and think back to some point where you've heard some climate denier said just that, almost verbatim. We demand more science. There's more information. All the information isn't in yet. We need, right? We develop this concept develops. Of critical importance, Hill argued that they should declare the positive value of science, skepticism of science itself. Right? Now, what that means is when you hear people say things like, it's only a theory of evolution, right? They're not using the word theory in the correct context. They're not using it like a scientist would use it. Scientists use words in different, and the reason that they use theory instead of fact is because they're always open to new information and new knowledge being added to the canon, right? So they can turn around and say, I have this theory, and they present forward the information, and then their scientific colleagues go out and actively try to disprove the theory. Then when they can't, it becomes peer-reviewed. Their peers reviewed it, can't find any flaws with it, or maybe contribute to it, and then that gets presented as the theory. And that theory is always there to be disproven. A most famous case that I would say without fear of contradiction, the theory of evolution. So our brothers and sisters of faith who believe in creation theory say that the theory of evolution, they use the word theory as a word to discredit it, but they're using it in the wrong context. And they're deliberately misusing science, scientific skepticism of science itself. So the good thing about science is that they're questioning themselves, that they continually question what they are putting out in order to advance science. So he's using that against science itself. So Hill understood, knowledge Hill understood was hard won and uncertain, and there would always be skeptics. What better strategy than to identify, solicit, support and amplify the views of the skeptics of the causal relationship between smoking and disease? Moreover, the liberal disbursement of tobacco industry research funding to academic scientists could draw new skeptics into the fold. So the goal, according to Hill, would be to build and broadcast a major scientific controversy. The public must get the message that the issue of the health effects of smoking remains an open question. Doubt, uncertainty, and the truism that there is more to know would become the industry's collective new mantra. Bum, bum, bum. Right? We know what we're... Does this ring in any bells? Because this is what... We're living in this age still today. This same approach and tactic is still being used today to deny climate change, to deny climate science. So I'm going to skip forward. They formed a tobacco industry research committee. They used the word research again to do with the mantra of the age. Research science sounds very official, sounds very good. People are going to buy it. I'm going to skip forward. So the Tobacco Industry Research Committee, TIRC, as its acronym, as gets referred to. So it was Hill who hit on the idea of creating an industry-sponsored research entity. Ultimately, it concluded the best public relations approach was for the industry to become a major sponsor of medical research. This tactic offered several essential advantages. The call for new research implied that existing studies were inadequate or flawed. That's a crafty bastard. Just by calling for new research implies that existing studies were inadequate or flawed. Don't have to say it. Someone else will say it for you. Implies it. Just drop it. Create doubt. You don't need to disprove anything. All you have to do is create doubt. Do you understand? Create doubt. Suggest. Imply. They don't go after the people that are saying smoking causes lung cancer. They don't go after them. They don't discredit them. They create doubt. And 70 years later, people are still smoking and dying of respiratory diseases caused by smoking and other diseases, brain hemorrhages, etc. Right? We know this, and people still will question. You will still hear these arguments being presented in a defense of smoking. But more importantly, when it comes to climate science, when it comes to climate change, the same arguments, the same tactic, the same approach that was developed in the early 50s is being used today. The industry had supported some individual research in recent years, the tobacco industry. But Hill's proposal offered the potential of a research program that would be controlled by the industry, yet promoted as independent. This still goes on. This was the public relations masterstroke. Hill understood that simply giving money to scientists through the National Institutes of Health or some other industry or some other entity, excuse me, for example, offered little opportunity to shape the public relations environment. However, offering funds directly to university-based scientists would enlist their support and dependence. Enlist their support and their dependence. What are they dependent on? The money to do the research. So you give them the money, they do the they're more likely, right? Moreover, it would have the added benefit of making academic institutions partners with the tobacco industry in its moment of crisis. Excuse me, you want to take a little drink? So, nearly done here. I'm not going to this. The secure academic support. I'm going to skip over that. This article is. I could, if I just sat here and read it, it would take about an hour and a half. But you should read it because it's brilliant. And here, so I'm going to skip way forward. So we've got the marketing industry on board. We've now got the academia on board. And by proxy, science, certain science, and now the media. So this is fantastic. First, they would note that the industry completely understood its important public relation, its important public responsibilities. And second, they would affirm that the industry was deeply committed to investigating all of the scientific questions relevant to resolving the controversy. Third, they urged skepticism regarding statistical studies. Finally, they offered members of the media a long list of independent skeptics to consult to ensure the balance of their presentations. So, right, so media, right? So at the time, few journalists had any sophisticated scientific education or training. And by fashioning controversy, Hill and Knowlton successfully secured media coverage that maintained by its very nature that tobacco science was unsolved. That's all you have to do. You don't have to prove shit. All you have to do is create doubt. You, 97% of climate scientists say that the Earth's warming up. 3% of them don't. You just create doubt. That's all you have to do. You don't have to prove a thing. Create doubt. Then the media go along with it because they think that by presenting one side of the argument and the other at the same time creates a 50-50 non-biased environment and we can have a discourse. But by the very fact of doing that proves that you've been manipulated and you've bit the hook. Right? And this is the point. And then the media is also, the media can't, pardon me, the media can't, well, they can, but they won't bite the hand that feeds it. So these big corporations, your Procter and Gamble's, your Nestle's, your who else am I thinking of? I did write this down. Whatever. Unilever. These companies, industries, or corporations own everything, all the brands. So you turn around and say, well, why would a television company that's talking about climate change not just go after what's become increasingly apparent and obvious? And stuff that they know, these are smart people, they know this stuff. Well, who's advertising on the channel? Nestle coffee and nappies for children and who owns all these brands are all owned. You look at that map. You ever see that map of the companies that Nestle own? There's like three or four big corporations own every brand in your supermarket, and all them adverts are all paid for by the two or three companies. So they're not going to go after those people, and they give them fair opportunity to voice their opinion, because that is a non-bias 50-50 media way of doing it. But it's bullshit. It's wrong to start with, right? So, okay, I'm going to push through here. Indeed, looking back at the half century that followed, the path-breaking science clearly linking cigarettes to disease and premature death, is striking to note the utter lack of serious and effective regulatory action on the part of the federal government, obviously an American-based journalists. So, after the 1964 Surgeon General's report, this is law, even as some industry executives, including lawyers, offered proposals for modifying the decades-old not-proven claim by the policy committee. The policy committee strongly resisted any deviation from this traditional position. So they had laid out, create a not-proven, create the doubt. There is other scientific opinion on this subject. By 1964, the industry, even after the Surgeon General had reported that cigarettes, the American Surgeon General had reported that cigarettes do indeed cause harm, the industry, the people in the industry body were urging a change of tact, modifying the decade-old not proven claim. But Hill resisted. He said, no, stay. So the committee feared any discussion of modifying the product or openly researching its biologically active properties could be viewed in the courts as an implied admission that the manufacturers knew that the product was harmful. Any move away from an agnostic public posture could, it was argued, lead to high-risk litigation. Even as the industry said, so the dilemma would shape the politics into the 21st century. So I'm going to skip forward right to the end here. So this is the last bit. I know this is lengthy. I did warn you this is going to be a big one going in. So, conclusions. The industry insistence at the direction of Hill and Knowlton on the notion of no proof and the need for more research was an inspired, if cynical, manipulation of the natural tendencies within science to encourage scepticism and seek more complete answers to important questions. This is fascinating. This is the last bit, and this brings us right up to the current, where we are today. Hill and Knowlton had served its tobacco's clients with commitment and fidelity, and with great success, but the firm had also taken its clients across a critical moral barrier that would have two important effects on American science and society. Trust in science, confidence in the media, and social responsibility of the corporate enterprise were all substantially harmed by Hill and Knowlton's efforts on behalf of the tobacco industry. By making science fair game in the battle of public relations, the tobacco industry set a destructive precedent that would affect future debates on subjects ranging from global warming to food and pharmaceuticals. Not exclusively, inclusive. In addition, by insinuating itself so significantly into the practice of journalism, Hill and Knowlton compromised the legitimacy and authority of the very instruments upon which public relations depended. Okay, I'm going to link to that article. You should read it all the way through. It's fascinating and it explains perfectly why we're here. Why are we sitting here in 2020 in the maw of an impending environmental global catastrophe, and we're doing fuck all about it? And the ones, people that are being discredited, people like Bill McKibben and everybody else, being discredited all over the place by shitty documentaries like this. And this is where we come to. So to expand on that a little further, I have been sent, since this COVID thing started, must have been sent 10 or 15 or 20 YouTube documentaries or videos Facebook links and etc. of some fucking doctor. Did you see those two doctors in Bakersfield in California sitting at the table going, those two guys were just wanted to get their businesses reopened. They don't give a fuck. And you look into their political history, they're very MAGA guys and all the rest of it. And I'm not going to go, I'm not going to go down that. If they, their political choices are their political choices, but they were presenting themselves as unbiased observers of a situation, and they were not. And I got sent that video by three different people, right? Three different people, friends of mine, sent me that video as evidence of why this whole COVID crisis is bullshit. And this is where I'm getting to. Again, with the conspiracy theories, it's George Soros, it's China this, it's that, blah, blah. It's all to do with this. It all comes from this discrediting of science itself. People walking around looking into a mobile phone, some Karen outside a fucking Waffle House in Florida ranting why it's closed, and it's her fucking American right to get into it, on a phone made by science, discrediting science, sitting there discrediting. The hypocrisy is astounding and stunning to me. But this is where it comes from. And this is why it started. Why can you so forcefully and confidently rant about why these scientists are all puppets and wrong and et cetera, et cetera? And you're sitting there with, you don't even know how, you don't even understand the language of science, how science works, what it's for to begin with, but you confidently dismiss everything that it offers as a reasoned and thought out argument and presents as fact, researched and peer reviewed. And this is why we've got here. And this is why we've got to Michael Moore's documentary, which has been roundly discredited. Roundly discredited, and he is still standing over it. I hope he changes his mind, but this is the point. So they conclude in the documentary, which you should watch, but they conclude in the documentary that the problem is overpopulation. Now, overpopulation is a very, very dangerous route to go down when it comes to dealing with the problems that we have on this planet. When you start saying that the problem is that we've got too many people. The problem is not that. The problem is that we overconsume. The problem is inherent in capitalism. The old adage, we live on a, you can't have infinite growth on a planet with finite resources, right? So that's obvious. A child can see that. I figured that out years ago, before I knew I was a socialist, when I had no access to this information. I have no formal education, as you fucking know, right? But I realized I was a socialist back then without realizing what a socialist was. And I knew that I was anti-capitalist before I knew what before I truly understood what capitalism was. Because I figured out that if the stock market is dependent on eternal growth, how the fuck is that going to work? So I figured that out on my own. Been told by nobody. So the problem is not overpopulation. The problem is overconsumption. And the documentary posits that for us to continue our current levels of consumption, we need to depopulate the planet. Now, this is I'll go into this in the next part of this, why this is very dangerous. This goes back to 17th century eugenics. But our 18th century eugenics, but that it's population is not the problem. Cutting down rainforests in order to plant palm oil plantations, palm oil, which is a completely unnecessary product, a cheap bulker used to get fractions of pennies to generate fractions of pennies of profit on a product. We don't need palm oil, but we're destroying habitat and destroying species and destroying our planet in the process, so that these Unilevers, Nestle's, etc., etc., can squeeze out fractions of a fraction of a cent of profit. That's where we are. And that's why they get away with it. And it started here. It started with this. And this is why this Michael Moore documentary is fucking horseshit. And it's wickedly horseshit. And it's willfully horseshit. Part two of this, I'm going to go through the points that they make discrediting green energy and the green energy movement. They discredit it. And if you don't know what you're looking at, you think they're talking sense, because it's presented in a high dollar way, but it's nonsense. It's all bullshit. So my summary of this, why this tobacco industry approach is connected to the Michael Moore thing, it creates doubt, and that's the point. Michael Moore's documentary, you watch, it's already been picked up by all the right-wing media and all the right-wing press. Breitbart are quoting it and using it, you know, Fox News, etc., etc. And they're using it as an example to undermine the green, let's call it the green movement in general. And it's going to be used for a decade or more. This documentary is going to be referenced every time a right wing or anti environmental movement news report is made or written, television program, etc., whatever, you know what I'm talking about, they're going to reference this documentary, and it's created doubt. And Michael Moore has done the fossil fuel industry a great service in this. And that's my point. What the tobacco industry and the marketing people and the public relations people did for the tobacco industry in the 50s, Michael Moore has done for the fossil fuel industry in 2020. The solution to our climate issues is not population control. It's environmentalism, proper environmentalism. And as I said, I'm going to go through the documentary in the next episode of this podcast and just debunk. And if I can do, well, I didn't do it. I mean, I'm using other people's knowledge and research. But if I can find this stuff is readily available, and all the journalists in the world should be out there slamming this, but they're not. Again, because of that connection to they won't bite the hand that feeds them. So I'm going to summary my whole thing. That's my point. The doubt that the tobacco industry, that approach of creating doubt that the tobacco industry pioneered. Michael Moore's done it for free. And it's going to be, you watch, this is going to be referenced time and time and time and time again. And I get sent videos by some Karen outside her Waffle House in Florida ranting into her phone, by some right-wing doctors who just want to reopen their businesses in Bakersfield in California without anyone referencing their political politics or their personal politics. But nobody sent me the video that I'm going to use to debunk this Michael Moore video until last night. That guy, A.S. Seagal, that I mentioned on Twitter, he sent it to me. One person sent it to me, but three people sent me the other things. Four people sent me the other things. You get what I'm saying? And this is the fucking problem. Whenever we step away from the scientific consensus, we leave ourselves open to this sort of abuse. And this is abuse. It's abuse of fact. Science fact. As much as again, science allows itself to be critiqued. So who knows what science fact means? But anyway, so here we go. Like, share, subscribe, please. Follow me on Twitter. I started a Twitter account. It's looking very skinny over there. There's only a few people on it. Decided to jump back into the world of Twitter again in order to get information for things like this, and I'm glad I did because it's paid dividends already. So follow me on Twitter. It's @abonnevilles, or if you just search Andy, that's in the Bonnevilles podcast, or I will put the link underneath. And you can follow me on Instagram as well. So same again, Andy, that's in the Bonnevilles on Instagram. And there we go. I'm gonna call this. So hope you enjoyed, and we will. I'm gonna get a cup of coffee and something to eat. Pick this up. Bye.